I'd like to introduce Leslie Daigle, who is the Chief Internet Technology Officer of the Internet Society. And she's been actively involved in shaping the Internet's evolution for more than a dozen years, and following her work with the Internet Engineering Task Force, IETF, and being the chair of the Internet Architecture Board, the IAB, Daigle's role with the Internet Society is to provide strategic leadership on important technical issues as they relate to ISOC's ongoing programs. So,
good morning, and thank you, David. All right. Let's see if I can get this technology to work. There we go. I think. All right. So the panel session we have this morning, I'm going to give some brief introductory remarks, and then we will hear considerable discussion from our esteemed panelists. So really quickly, I'd like to introduce the panel. We have Hunter Newby, CEO of Allied Fiber; Link Hoeing, VP of Internet Technology Policy at Verizon; Chris Libertelli, Senior Director, Government Regulatory Affairs at Skype; and Nick Gall, Vice President, Gartner Research. So first, as I said, I'll give a few opening remarks just to sort of do some scene setting for us for this panel. And then we're going to hear from the panelists' perspective. We'll give everybody an opportunity to provide some opening remarks, and then we'll get to some dialogue and some Q&A, and hopefully we will have a robust discussion. I'm certainly encouraged by the level of interactivity in the last session, and I'm looking forward to hearing from all of you some more. So just some terms of reference. So first of all, what is the Internet? It's easy to say that the Internet is that, you know, that thing that we turn on in the morning, and it's the thing that we always get the phone call from the spouse when it isn't working at home. But really, you know, fundamentally, if we want to be crisp in talking about major Internet issues, we do have to have some crisp terminology in terms of what actually is the Internet. So from a technical perspective, the Internet actually is a system of interconnected networks that are performing according to the Internet Engineering Task Force's protocol standards and best practices for communicating with resources and endpoints regionally globally throughout the Internet. And all of those words are measured and important in terms of the global nature of it, in terms of the Internet working, so on and so forth. And then we can say that an Internet service is providing the connection to the Internet for an endpoint or network, and either directly or through a proxy, to provide access to the rest of the Internet with non-discriminatory best practice, best effort services. And that's kind of key as well. You will probably get your internet connection from an Internet access provider, and that access provider is providing essentially the connection over a last mile, whatever that last mile may be, whether it's DSL, cable connection, carrier pigeons, which has been done, or any other form of connection. And these companies are responsible for the experience over that connection. So that all seems fairly straightforward and maybe a little bit grinding through some details, but there are some points of confusion. The Internet is based on the Internet Protocol Standard, IP standards. It turns out that those standards are very useful for networking. Indeed, they're useful for other forms of networking as well. And it is not at all uncommon at this point to be providing a number of services over IP in a network, usually over a particular network and not an internetwork. And some of those services you may be familiar with. Your home telephone service may now be being offered over an IP network. But that is as distinct from the Internet, which is a service being offered over the IP network. There are also what so-called over-the-top services. These are other services offered other than in your access, retail access network, that you may be using over the top of the Internet. So a fundamental concept: Internet as a service. So Internet access retailers can and should be clear about what they are offering you by way of internet service. What is the expected performance of that link? What is, you know, what should you actually expect out of the service? And then they should deliver that. That, though, should be considered separately from any other IP-based services that they may be offering you, may be offering on the same infrastructure. The key point there is that as long as that internet service that you're offered is happening according to the service levels that have been advertised, you shouldn't have to care what other things that your retail access provider may be doing with their infrastructure. So, and then at the Internet Society, our focus is on ensuring that that internet service isn't just the least common denominator service offering, but that in fact it continues to flourish and provide the global network that is the basis for so many innovations that we've come to know and love, certainly not the least of which is the World Wide Web. So that is pretty much it by way of setting the scene for the terminology today. So today's panel, as you see in your programs, it was actually set with some framing questions for discussion. So I'm not going to run through these questions, but certainly keep them in mind as the sorts of things that the panelists had in mind when they were putting together their remarks. And then at this point, I would like to pass it over to the panel to make their remarks. So first, can I invite you, Hunter, to make your remarks?
Certainly. Thank you. Hello, I'm Hunter Newby, the CEO of Allied Fiber. I'd like to thank the Internet Society for asking me to be here and all of you for taking the time out of your day to come and listen and participate. I find it an honor to be here in the presence of such great people and thinkers and builders and contributors to our society today. What I'd like to focus on in terms of what our common understanding is, sort of everybody coming in the room and having a 101 level course under our belts, is the definition of terms. So just touch on a couple of them lightly. And Leslie actually just did this. Internet protocol is not the internet. That's a really important concept to understand. VOIP does not mean voice over the internet. The World Wide Web is not the internet, and the internet's not the World Wide Web. Net neutrality is not internet neutrality. It's network neutrality. And there's a big difference between the definition of those terms as per the FCC and you'll find in a court of law. The internet, as much as it is a collection of IP networks that are interconnected, begins at the physical layer. And I spend most of the past 10 plus years at layer one, actually zero, I suppose, defining a set of standards and rules for interconnecting disparate networks at the physical layer. Without the physical layer, there is no layer two, and there is no layer three, and there's no public layer three or any other layer in the stack. To try and bring this into focus, some of the motto, I suppose, a shared, open, and transparent internet is what the Internet Society seeks. In my mind, the best way to ensure that is at the physical layer. If you have access to fiber, dark fiber of your own that you can light, that's meaningful, that has physical proximity to other networks that are on different fiber systems and paths, you can light that fiber, put dense wave division multiplexing, Ethernet switches and routers on it, and interconnect to those other IP networks without oversight or regulation, which is what's being discussed here at the higher layers and the basis of an open and free internet. I completely agree with that. And I think that that needs to manifest at the physical layer. So there needs to be an appreciation for what occurs at one. And the interconnections for public IP networks that create the basis of the public internet take place in buildings. Sometimes they're referred to as carrier hotels. Sometimes they're referred to as internet peering points or exchange points. They are physical locations on planet Earth with a longitude and latitude, an actual specific geography, not a cloud, not in reference to air. These buildings are quite important. And as it relates to the master switch, which Sir Tim mentioned, and Egypt, which comes to mind, there is a particular building in Egypt which was commandeered by the government, and basically that's where the internet was shut off. Take that into context and think about it and project it back in the U.S. Where are those buildings? Who owns them? Who controls them? And what happens within them? Who makes the rules? Who's allowed to connect to whom? And then how do you connect between those buildings? Because that is the physical consistency of the public internet and all other networks that exist within the U.S. and any other country. So I would like to have the conversation sort of at that level, and then we can discuss the shared, open, and transparent internet above it from that vantage. Thank you.
Thank you, Hunter. Link, would you like to go ahead and make some remarks?
So I should start out with a disclaimer, Leslie. I don't think we've ever used carrier pigeon for any of our services to date, but it's an interesting idea. I hadn't thought of that before. I spend a lot of time thinking about internet policy, and the truth is that aside from some of the key policy questions like privacy, the hardest thing for me to fathom is, in fact, defining just what the internet is. There are a wide array of definitions, and Leslie talked about some, and most of them go back to the technologies or the protocols involved in making the internet work. And all of these are important factors to me, but what makes the internet is the cooperation and multi-stakeholder arrangements that undergird its operations. It's unique in that sense. It's decentralized. It's a network of networks that do actually interconnect, and generally it works quite well. One really good definition that helps, I think, explain it a little better for me is this one: a voluntary agreement among network operators to exchange traffic for their mutual benefit. This definition, too, has its flaws. After all, it's focused on the network providers and the networks themselves, not on the users, and it also doesn't talk a lot about what other things make the internet valuable. But this focus on the voluntary nature of the agreements and the collaborative nature of how these agreements are reached, I think, is really an important concept. There are incentives for these companies to interconnect and exchange traffic. This also underscores to me how well these interrelationships generally work. What really brought this home to me was a recent study by the Packet Clearinghouse that was done a few weeks ago. And in that study, they surveyed peering arrangements on the internet and reached the following conclusion. The internet, or network of networks, consists of about 5,039 internet service providers. I don't know how they got that precise, frankly. But which are interconnected with one another in a sparse mesh. Each of the interconnecting links takes one of two forms, transit or peering. And of the total analyzed agreements that they looked at, 99% were actually handshakes, not even written agreements. In their view, this actually demonstrates how well these interconnection processes work and how well these companies work together to take the traffic back and forth. So this is one indicator to me that we're actually having a lot of success in making sure the internet continues to operate. The interconnection process does seem to work pretty well. But none of this is easy work. Interconnecting is one thing. Making the traffic work and making it get to the consumer as they want it to get to them is another thing. On our network, for example, every day about 100 million people connect in one form or another. About 2.5 billion text messages are sent back and forth. Hundreds of emails are exchanged. Literally gigabytes of video are exchanged. And yes, we still connect about 1.5 billion phone calls every day as well. We have to work with other networks to make this work. We have to work with backbone providers, and we have to work with a lot of companies globally to make this happen. New research from Analysis Mason confirms that the internet is not only becoming more global, but also better reflects the reach of the internet, particularly into less developed corners of the world. Not too long ago, traffic very often transited through the U.S., no matter where it was headed or where it originated. Many ISPs have worked together in putting facilities in less developed parts of the world, and connection points, sometimes called IXPs, have sprung up around the world to allow interconnection among various ISPs globally. This means a lot of traffic now can actually be generated and actually transited back and forth regionally rather than have to go transit through major countries, which is another major development I think that's very positive. All of this suggests that the cooperative and competitive dynamics of the internet play out all over the world each and every day and generally without incident. Yes, there are flare-ups, there are disputes, there are conflicts. How could there not be with thousands of companies trying to interconnect and send data back and forth? But based on the PCH report, most of these network interrelationships seem to work out positively in the long run. This success is reflected in part, I think, too, in the investments companies are making to actually upgrade and advance their networks. We have been investing about $16 to $17 billion a year for many years now, in part to build out our fiber-to-the-home technology and also to build the new 4G LTE-based mobile broadband networks. We've also built a global fiber network that connects to 2,700 cities in 150 countries, which has about 450,000 route miles of fiber, which is enough to circle the globe probably 18 times. So all of these networks are expanding in capacity, and the U.S., I think, in many ways, is clearly leading in 4G deployment in particular. We're deploying it more quickly, and we're actually seeing devices now being deployed more quickly. Contrary to popular belief, too, our backbones are also advancing. We're now beginning to implement 100 gigabit technologies in our backbones. And our, of course, fiber-to-the-home networks can offer a lot of speed. In fact, we've actually tested a 1 gigabit connection to a home recently and very successfully. We're also pursuing new approaches to reach consumers as part of this investment process. One of our leaders at the CES show this year, the Consumer Electronics Show, said it best in my view, no one company or organization can do it alone. All of this requires cooperation, collaboration, and yes, competition as well. We recognize that all these factors are part of the heart of the internet. So one part of this is we have operationalized lab technologies to try to test LG and 4G technologies more aggressively. We did have a lab now in Waltham, which is operational. It lets entrepreneurs come in and take devices and try them in an operating 4G environment. There are no non-discrimination or non-disclosure agreements, so they basically come in, they test the device, we help them engineer it so it works well on the network, and if they want to work with us on developing the product further, fine. If they don't, they can walk out and do it any way they want to. We also have a number of venture capital companies there to help them to get the financing if they, in fact, do want to move forward. So it's another model, which is you probably wouldn't have seen 10 years ago. It's basically an open lab trying to get people to develop LG technologies so that they, in fact, move forward quicker. So innovation, collaboration, and competition, these are fundamental, and I think they are being reflected every day in what's going on in the investment and advancements of these networks. And consumers do have more choices, and there's a lot more going on now than there used to be, I think, in many ways, especially new business models and new approaches to the consumer. A recent Harvard University paper, it really put it well. They said older technologies like electricity were disruptive, but then led to a period of stability as companies learned how to adopt the new technology. We've entered a new phase in that pattern. Disruption followed by stabilization has itself been disrupted. Businesses and social institutions constantly find themselves racing to catch up and learn the steadily improving and changing technologies in the communications and IT space. So it's not the old pattern anymore. We just kind of get the new innovations and they kind of die down or get adopted widely and then kind of we go on for something new. It continuously happens, new innovation and new technologies. So I'm generally an optimist, but we do have challenges, and there are four issues that I wanted to briefly mention that I think are some challenges we have going forward. First, even though we are deploying 4G technology now and LTE technology, I do believe we're going to need more spectrum fairly quickly. And so the administration's focus on that is a very important thing, and it's going to take some time to make that happen, but it's really important that we start moving forward that quickly. We got our lead in 4G deployment in this country in part because we did do the DTV transition, free up spectrum so that we could actually have auctions back in earlier this last part of the last decade, and that helped us deploy more quickly. Secondly, there are really important consumer issues, too, that need to be addressed, and one of them, for example, is privacy. New legislation by Senators Kerry and McCain offers a lot of promise as a framework for privacy, in our view. We haven't endorsed it, but we think there's some good mechanisms in that bill. And the Commerce Department's own assessment of privacy in their white paper recently was quite well done as well. Good models, I think, for how to do a good privacy framework. Third, innovation is moving so rapidly that it's imperative that regulation be looked at with great caution. While there may be situations that arise that cause debate or concerns that make people believe we need to actually step in some way with a government role, I think the multi-stakeholder approach we've used has generally worked well, and we should try to do that as much as we can. And finally, I do believe that even though we believe in the multi-stakeholder approach, it is fraying at the edges. There is constant pressure for intervention of all kinds, and we do need to find ways to keep pushing back on that. And it's a very important aspect from Verizon's standpoint to keep that process in place as much as possible, which is one of the reasons we're a major member of the ISOC and very much involved in what they're doing. We think it's very important work. Thank you.
Thank you. And Chris, if you would go ahead. Thank you.
Thanks, Leslie. I'm going to make two or three points, and hopefully very, very briefly. When you have people like Vint Cerf and Professor Jonathan Askin in the audience, I think it's far better for the Skype representative to speak quickly and briefly so we can get into questions, because I'm much more interested in your questions than me downloading to you in a one-way conversation. I spent 4 years working at the FCC for the chairman of the FCC, so I do public policy work for Skype, and I feel like I need to always confess that bias before I speak, because I do come at this from the perspective of someone who's worked in government now at Skype as we transition Skype into a new ownership structure, hopefully in the next few months. And the two or three points I wanted to make really are about the public policy environment. They're less technical. They're more about what's happening in D.C. these days, because I think there is perhaps less public involvement today than there was last year when we were fighting the net neutrality fights. And I think that's a mistake, because I think there are some very important decisions that are going to be made with decisions about your money, particularly in the universal service context, that's worthy of our attention. The first point I wanted to make was, as I was coming up here on the train from D.C., I reread parts of Jonathan Zittrain's book, The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It. And I read that in combination with Tim Wu's book, The Master Switch. And I think if there are two books that are the best discussions of jurisdiction and how public policy is expressed on the internet, I think those are the two best discussions. And what you take away, what I took away from those two pieces, is we really have a fundamental problem with jurisdiction in this space. To the extent there is a public policy consensus that we should have this kind of interconnection regime or that kind of universal service regime, it is built on an assumption of national sovereignty. And for Skype, there are real limits on territorial jurisdiction and the reach of governments to go after or to regulate companies which are largely offshore. I don't know if you appreciate that when you download Skype and you agree to our terms of service, you're actually virtually traveling to Luxembourg and agreeing to a term of service with the company based on Luxembourg law. And I think that says something about the very lightweight way internet companies touch national boundaries, and also the limits of what regulators in places like D.C. and Brussels can do to establish interconnection regimes that are pro-consumer. I think that leads you to a world where best practices and voluntary arrangements are likely to be more important than government policies, at least in the short term. This debate reminds me a little bit of the debate around repatriation and moving money that's offshore back into the United States. There's a limit to how much the government can do to encourage that. Certainly, they could change tax rates to bring it back into the United States. But there's likewise a limit to the telecommunications regulatory environment. And I think that means that industry is going to drive some of these solutions, not government. But that isn't to say that government doesn't have a really important role when it comes to the access part of the network. Things like, you know, doling out wireless licenses or dealing with traditional PSTN interconnection regimes. Absolutely, as we've seen in the States, that's an important part of enhancing consumer welfare. And I think one of the reasons why it's been so difficult for D.C. to get their head around the AT&T T-Mobile merger is we're in a space where we haven't rearticulated what success looks like in terms of public policy. And what I mean by that is, you know, around 1996, when the U.S. Congress last passed the Telecom Act, there was a bipartisan consensus that we were going to pass this bill and the end state was going to be something called intermodal competition, right? What does that mean? That means that cable companies would compete with Lynx Company, and Lynx Company would have a wireless network which would compete with AT&T, and you could compare industry developments, mergers, policies against that goal. Right? I'm not sure we have a clear articulation of what that goal is today. For Skype, it's about something called multimodal competition, which is to say access layer interconnection is very important, and we should have competition and innovation at that layer, absolutely. But the real game, at least from our perspective, is really happening at the higher layers of the protocol stack. So we should have competition at the access layer, but also an articulation of what success looks like at the application layer. And what that looks like, I think, is a policy of maximum openness, maximum competition innovation between companies like Skype and Google and others who are building applications higher up in the protocol stack. The third point I want to make is really about what's happening in DC that affects the way these access networks are interconnecting or non-interconnecting or how they're funded. And that really has to do with something called the Universal Service Reform Effort. Right now, there are a set of industry negotiations that, it might surprise you to know, are going to move $8 billion of our financial resources, our money, from one provider to the next with the goal of supporting a ubiquitous, affordable network. And the Obama administration, rightly in our view, has changed that dynamic to make it about supporting broadband. That's, I think, the right articulation of what success looks like. But what I would say is, like the net neutrality debate, where we had a great deal of public involvement, this one is unlike the net neutrality debate in that we have much less public involvement in how that process is playing out. And I think if there's one public policy issue in D.C. that's important for the future of the Internet and what it looks like and how it's defined, it's this universal service reform effort and how those subsidies are parsed out to particularly smaller rural phone companies. The questions that will be answered in that proceeding are critically important if we're going to have a ubiquitous, interconnected, broadband-enabled Internet. And it's really one that I think we all as a society should do more to engage the FCC on, particularly as this industry group comes forward with a proposal and suggests ways for policymakers to move forward. So I'm going to leave it there. Like I said, I'm much more interested in your questions and happy to answer any questions you have about Skype and what our future looks like. Thanks.
Thank you, Chris. And Nick, would you like to round out the remarks?
Sure. Wow. It sounds really complicated. It sounds like a really, really complicated problem, just hearing the former three panelists address this. So I'm certainly not going to try to solve that problem here. In fact, I'm simply going to try to frame the problem, because I think that's three-quarters of the battle. And there's no one way to frame it, because this is a wicked problem. It's not a wicked problem because I'm from Boston. We like to say wicked in front of things. It's a wicked problem because two design thinkers back in the 70s coined the term wicked problem to explain a class of problems that defied any easy solutions. In fact, they have 10 criteria for determining whether something's a wicked problem. And one, I think, applies here especially. Criteria number 9, which is the choice of explanation of the problem determines how it will be addressed, i.e. the framing issue, right? How we frame this problem is going to have a huge impact on how we think we've solved it. So let me frame it from the point of view of the endpoint, from the users, because that's really where I come from. I've been using the Internet since 1980. Thank you, Vint. Thank you, Tim, for at least the 90s part of it. I've made career decisions as well as job choices based on my access to the Internet. So for me, this is personally very important, as well as, I'm sure, publicly important as well. In that time, one of the key things that struck me about the Internet is, and the topic of this panel is about innovation. The Internet is about innovation, and the topic of our panel discussion today is the future of innovation in the Internet. Now, one of the problems here is, where do we do the innovation? If you will, which layer or layers do the innovation? That's the crux of the matter for me. That's the frame I want to put on it. And if you put it in that frame, then it's just the good old end-to-end argument all over again. Do we do the innovation at the endpoints where companies like Skype and Google and Microsoft and, you know, whoever, or Tim Berners-Lee, you know, just in his lab doing it on his own, can they innovate pretty much without restraint at the endpoints and the network has to accept the protocols they put on top, whether they're hostile or not? Or do we want to innovate down at layer 0? Or 1 or 2 or 3 or 4. That would be great if we could innovate everywhere, but we can't. And just to get the controversy going a little bit, I disagree that the traditional disruption stabilization cycle Link referred to has been disrupted. I don't think so. As protocols become more widely established, more general purpose in nature, and more interdependent with upper levels, their innovation slows down. Right? We're still on IPv4. Right? Now, you can innovate underneath IPv4, and you can innovate on top of IPv4, but you can't change IPv4. At least it's been a real struggle, right? A 20-year struggle. So there is an issue about the stability of some layers being the enabler of innovation and experimentation of other layers. One of the best works I've ever read on this issue from an economic business perspective is Design Rules, The Power of Modularity by Baldwin and Clark. And it's been applied to a number of industries, including the internet itself. And the main thrust is that the option value created by a set of interfaces, a technology, can create unmanageable designs, something that no one can really control. They can't control the innovation. They can't control the outcomes. They can't control the profit streams. And that leads to the problem of who makes the profit when that happens, right? Because innovation and profit, in at least a capitalist society, go hand in hand. And so where we decide that the most profits should be, it will determine where we have the most innovation. So I look forward to the debate and the questions.
Great. And thank you very much, Nick. Although I would like to push back on one of your points that we can't change IPv4. It's an area near and dear to the Internet Society's heart.
We're getting there.
We, in fact, had a little event last week, and I can tell you that this morning in Chicago at a cable meeting, Best Buy is talking about what they should actually tell their customers on the floor in 2 minutes or less about IPv6. We're making progress. All right. Yes.
Which is good. I should say it slows down. It doesn't stop. Yeah. How about it slows down?
Indeed. It doesn't take away from your overall point. So thank you, and thank you all panelists. Before we open it up to the floor, and before I start asking some probing questions, I would like to know if any of you thought of some interesting questions to ask each other to kick the dialogue off and warm up. Crickets. Yes.
Are the Bruins going to win? That's all I want to know.
Which one?
Are the Bruins going to win game 7?
Oh, absolutely.
All right. That's
absolutely.
That's my question. That's all I care about.
All right, then. So maybe I will start with one of our agreed discussion questions. The internet started as an inherently collaborative network, indeed an internet work. So what is the general internet in this day and age, and what are the qualities of it that need to be preserved or nurtured in order to ensure it continues to provide the environment for innovation? And are there any that are, in fact, not relevant? Any takers?
I'll take a crack at that, because I left out one part. In my interest to get to the questions, I left out one of the parts that I'm going to use for my framing of the internet. It's actually the definition used in the FCC's Open Internet report back in December, which I thought was pretty good overall. So let me read it to you verbatim, and then I'll summarize it. The internet is a mass market retail service by wire or radio that provides the capability to transmit data and receive data from all or substantially all internet endpoints. I'll stop there. There's a little bit more, but that's the essence of it. The internet is, with all due respect to Verizon and others, it is not layer zero. It is not the network itself. It's the endpoints. That's the internet. It's the endpoints. And everything else is really a means to an end of that set of endpoints. I could have the world's most sophisticated, most inexpensive communications pathways, but if I can't reach out to the world and reach virtually all endpoints, I don't have the internet. So for me, that's the key issue here is when it comes to neutrality is, can I have access to virtually all the endpoints? And I looked for a definition of endpoint in the 300-page whatever report. I didn't really find a good one. I would characterize endpoints as not just necessarily just a website or just the ports, although that's all part of it, but it's really any protocol or API, if you will, that that endpoint wants to offer up. So I have to be able to have access to any endpoint, and that endpoint can use any protocol it wants to on top of the internet. Then we have the public internet.
So just a few words about that definition. I think we spent way too much time last summer trying to figure out the right words to use in the FCC's order. I mean, the commission really tortured over that part of the FCC's order to get it just right. And I understand why they did that. They were trying to come up with a tight definition that encompassed what they were trying to, the problem they were trying to solve. But for Skype, the question was always really about how consumers experience the internet. What I mean by that is that there are a set of expectations that have been built up over the last, say, 10, 15 years around what internet access is, right? The carriers know what internet access is. Consumers, when they walk into a Verizon or AT&T or Cricket store and they buy internet access, I think they've come to understand what that is, and it means the ability to go anywhere you want to on the web, to connect up a device and run Skype, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's the more important perspective to look at the definition of the internet from, and the most important, I think one of the most important words in that definition is radio. There should be no distinction in terms of public policy between fixed line and wireless. Yes, wireless networks need to be perhaps more aggressively managed because contention scenarios are more acute, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not challenging that notion. But we're going to go to a world very soon where one Skype conversation may begin on this device, which may be connected to a physical network. The middle of the conversation might be on an unlicensed wireless network, and the end of the conversation might be on a licensed 4G connection. And in that environment, it all should be seamless. It all should be one internet experience with multiple services defined at the application layer. So the wireless piece of that definition, I hope, will endure, and that the commission will come up with some good harmonizing rules to treat fixed line internet access the same as wireless internet access.
One of the reasons that I was, as I said in my comments, very optimistic about where we're going with the internet is that I do believe that the expectations that consumers have about what they should be able to do on the internet are widespread and acknowledged, and everybody knows it, including us as providers. So that really provides a lot of reassurance that, in fact, they're going to be able to get what they want in terms of connectivity to the various sites they want to go to. I think another piece of that that helps, though, and that's why, to me, the investment piece of this is an important discussion, is to make sure that we try to encourage continuing advancement of these networks so they can, in fact, do more with it, too. It's not just getting to the sites. It's also being able to do things they want to do on it, and some of those things require a lot of capacity, and some of them require better latency, for example. So on the LTE network that we're deploying, we're spending a lot of time on latency. It's a really very low latency network. Chris and I were talking before the event here, and I had this comment repeatedly from people saying it's as good as my Fios network, my fiber to the home network, in terms of the connectivity. It really provides good throughput and good latency. All those take time and engineering to do. So it's a lot of work, but I think it's actually paying off. And the more capacity and the more advances we have in these networks, the more people can do with them, and the more the kinds of innovation you're talking about will happen. The only criticism I would have of what you said was that we're an integral part of all this too. The way you're discussing it, it sounds like we're not part of this technology environment that's being that is the internet. And the truth is, we are. We're innovating in different ways, but we are providing innovations. We're also experimenting with different business models. If you went into a Verizon wireless store 10 years ago, you would have had a phone that we would have spent 18 months doing testing on, pretty tightly integrated apps that you could or could not buy depending on what you wanted, and a fairly limited number of features. Today you go in there and basically you might as well have Apple and Google and others in that store with you, because a lot of people are driven by those decisions first and foremost and not just by the network. So the whole environment has changed in part because it is a collaborative environment, one where you've got to work with other partners to make the value of this get to the consumer, and it's not as easy as it used to be. There is competition and a lot more choice than there used to be.
I would add to the comments made by the panelists that the way that I see this is really the yin and the yang. I mean, you look at the yin and the yang and the symbol, and it represents to me balance. And it's not 50-50 in the sense of a straight line through a circle. It's a wave, which has some connotation to what we do here. It's not going to always be equal. It's always sometimes going to be a little bit more, a little bit less, but in the end, it's all balanced. So, yeah, I believe the applications drive the network. I believe the endpoints are important, but I also believe that without the core, there is no way to connect the endpoints. And, you know, necessity being the mother of invention, you can't create an app if people can't access the app. And if there's only one network, then there will be controls. And I go back to Ben Franklin and the free press. Free press didn't mean that the paper was free, like it didn't cost money to buy it. It meant that the information in the paper wasn't under the oversight of the crown, of the king. And in a net neutrality parallel, if you have a single network that provides you all of your content, it can decide for you what you will see and not see. So the root of openness is based upon multiple physical paths, multiple printing presses in different places owned by independent people that print these things with the content that they choose to put in it, which is relevant to those that read it and not censored in any way. And that's the parallel that I draw. If there's anything that I think that really needs to be preserved about the internet to keep it open and neutral, it's the carrier-neutral physical layer interconnection facilities in the U.S. and around the world that are the basis of the internet. These are the peering points of the carrier hotels that I referred to earlier. For without layer one, there is no two or three, etc. There's no core, then there are no endpoints. And I appreciate all the other perspectives. I completely agree. Verizon is central to the development of the core network that applications like Skype ride over. And I would argue that innovation at layer one in physical fiber itself with single mode SMF28, SMF28E, SMF28E plus LL, which is a particular product type of a particular vendor, low loss fiber that exists today that was created within the last 5 years, did not exist 10 or 20 years ago. And it's more efficient for carrying 100 gigabit lambdas. And 100 gigabit lambdas are important to deploy because of economies of scale at the photon layer, which then support 100 gigabit Ethernet, which then supports LTE, which then supports apps. It's all connected. There's nothing isolated about any piece of the stack. It's all connected. So we must all appreciate each layer and its role. For if we take any of those layers for granted, they will be taken from us.
Can I respond?
Briefly.
Yeah, I agree it's all connected, but one of my favorite metaphors for the internet, which came from David Clark, the first chairperson of the IETF, is the hourglass diagram, the hourglass metaphor. And for me, that's what distinguishes the kind of innovation, you know, which is, you know, amazing innovation down to layers, you know, one and two. At the bottom of the hourglass. That can go on as much as we want, and we need it because we need more bandwidth, we need radio, not just landlines and so on. And the top of the hourglass is obviously all the cool applications, APIs like the web and so on, that get built on top of IP and TCP. But that narrow waist, right, the bottleneck in a way, for better or worse, is the IP protocol. And that's the part that in a way has to be stable, neutral, non-competitive, open, you know, all the key words. We don't have to do that below, and we don't have to do it above. Believe me, you know, everybody competes. Skype competes with other, you know, VoIP providers and so on. That's cool. But where we all cooperate, where we have to be neutral, is just at the narrow waist. And so there is a, although everything's connected, the power, the way the internet was modularized or layered was there's that one key information hiding layer that lets us go about innovating on both ends of it, or both top and bottom of it, without interfering with one another. We've got to preserve that.
So if I may just make a comment on your comment, certainly we need interoperability at the narrow waist. The extent to which we have interoperability at other layers, we do derive other benefits for being able to use building blocks, which is one of the reasons why we, you know, argue, for instance, for keeping DNS infrastructure open and not impeded by implementation of policy responses. So I think, and we heard this morning, interoperability is certainly key for some applications as well. I do actually have another question, but I'm going to hold it for later. I would like to come back to the question of whether we currently have internet service over wireless by the earlier definition, and the extent to which we don't, how will that impact future innovation, or will it change? Data plans today pass packets, but maybe don't provide point-to-point connectivity, for instance, between handsets. So I'd like to leave that thought with you and then turn to the floor and start taking some questions from you all. And I see the microphones are ready in the aisle.
Is it on? Okay.
And please do identify yourself.
Yes, my name is Patrice Lyons. I'm Corporate Counsel, Corporation for National Research Initiatives, and I've been involved in Internet matters for many, many years. I'm a lawyer by profession, so I get picky about words and what they mean, and a whole lot of words just flew by me this morning, like public versus private Internet. Well, you have the Internet. Or open internet versus open architecture, which is much more serious because really you're really talking about the open architecture internet here. But the question I wanted to ask, and my bar association tackled this several years back, and we did it in the context of 802.11 nets in an internet environment. And basically, I have a great interest in copyright law, so we were looking how to take the various elements that are involved in a managed information environment and how you would structure it and what then might be necessary to change legally, if anything. And one of the first things that we have really struggled with back then and really met some tentative conclusions is that the layered approach wasn't helpful. Over, under, you're talking about bits are bits, you're managing the environment, you're identifying, you have to have different ways to track things, different ways to protect things. Security was the most important thing that we were concerned with. So what we looked at then was a more integrated approach. And at the time, my corporation and the president, Bob Kahn, who had something to do with the TCPIP, we put a paper into the Working Group on Internet Governance where instead of just the layered approach, as the definition from 1995 of the Federal Networking Council of what it meant to be integrated internet, instead of just layered approach, we suggested that there also be an integrated approach, that you wouldn't close the door to one versus the other. And I seem to have heard today just mostly all about layers, but have you found it more acceptable in some of your applications, Skype perhaps, the integration of the different elements in the environment?
I would say, so when you talk about open architectures, I'm translating that into Skype land to mean our things like our open API program, which is a set of hooks that other companies, mostly software-defined companies, can link into Skype and use Skype, again, at the application layer. My reaction to your comment, and while I don't have experience specifically with your project, is I think we need to be aggressive about, you know, why are we going through these definitional battles? What problem are we trying to solve by either defining the different OSI layers or coming up with some alternative? And in public policy terms, it's always about whether consumers are harmed or whether one of the access providers or another entity is restricting output, raising price, doing things to harm consumers. That's the touchstone. And I guess I do feel like, particularly last summer at the FCC, we spent an inordinate amount of time coming up with definitions that are likely to be outpaced by technology anyway. So we should have some humility around this definitional exercise because it often doesn't have any kind of enduring relevance to consumers.
Okay, thank you. I do see that there are a number of questions in the back channel. I will take some of them, although I will observe some of them appear to me to be pretty particular questions to the panelists about their company affiliates business practices as opposed to the general topic of this panel.
One company in particular, I don't know why.
So I will use my moderator prerogative to not take those questions. If there is a panel general point that you want to make, I invite you to reframe. But before we go to those, any other questions on the floor at the moment? If we can get a mic to Vint.
Fantastic question.
Vint Cerf from Google. This is actually a question that goes to some of the things that Patrice mentioned. If we're overly strict about layering, there are all kinds of potential hazards. We understand that. If you don't know what the network is doing, you can't adapt to it. So the idea of porous layers, so you know something about what's going on in the layer below, can often provide some optimization. So I'm not a layer bigot by any stretch. I would like to point out, however, that architecturally, what's made the Internet remarkably flexible and resilient is having standard interfaces that are stable. This was the point that Nick made about the narrow waist is an example of that. The stability has permitted applications to be developed that are on top of those interfaces on the presumption that they aren't going to change dramatically. Of course, that makes them hard to change. That's why IPv4 and IPv6 have been such a struggle. But the important point I'd like to make is that not so much the layering as much as it is having stable interfaces that at various parts of the architecture of the system that allow people to rely on them.
Mm-hmm.
It is true, however, that there are coincidences. So, for example, there are physical things like the fibers that Hunter talks about or radio frequencies that we would talk about in the wireless world, and they correspond to places where there are standardized interfaces. Access to them, the procedures by which you modulate the signal and so on, are examples of those stable interfaces. If I could take advantage of the microphone to ask Link a specific question that Leslie alluded to but didn't get discussed. With regard to IP protocol itself and the wireless world and the Fios world that you live in, can we anticipate that IPv6 will actually be accessible from the handset so that programs that are running in the handset actually have IP addresses? And similarly, will we see that in Fios as well? Because at the moment, I'm not sure about the plans for introducing access to the IP layer in those two media.
Right. We, as you know, then we have IPv6 in the backbone, and we also have it in the wireless network, but not, as you say, in the handset. On Fios, I really don't know. You sent a note on that. I'm going to check into that. I don't know what the time frame is for IPv6 for Fios. It is not right now capable of doing that.
I'll just make one comment to what Vint, you just said. I completely agree with stability at the interface, and it all comes down to one word that you can underline bold and put an exclamation point after it: control. Everything's about control, and it all starts with dirt. I'm not kidding. Dirt right of way, access to land, and then the land, and you can build the roads, and you have the rights of way, and the buildings, and the physical layer, strictly as it relates to stability, access to a building, being able to go through the door and go into the room where all the other carriers are and physically connect to the other network. The ability to have that and to presume that you can have that creates stability and predictability in all the other functions of whatever your business is in a networked world. And that control, the underlying assets and rights to create that environment for the good of all people, essentially, is assumed and taken for granted. And that level of stability is what I believe we should seek to protect so that all the other layers can be equally protected and stable.
Okay, thanks. I'm going to take a back channel question at this point. So we have from Aram Sunrick from Rutgers. Relying on consumer expectation alone to define the scope and definition of the internet is very limiting. Most consumers don't have the expertise to describe needs and wants that are not currently within their scope of service. Thoughts from the panel?
Well, one, I disagree with that. Yeah. My dad is a 78-year-old internet user, and he knows as much about what he wants. And I'm not saying he knows the technology, but he knows what he wants, and he talks to a lot of other people, and he also understands what they have. So I think in general terms, they do know what they want. Can they translate into how you change your network to do that? No, of course not. I think another thing about the internet, though, that I've always valued is that there are so many other people on the internet who are experts at this stuff that are constantly watching themselves and offering their own expertise to help make things better, that over time, a lot of these things do get fixed because of them as well, good and bad. And we've seen examples of that repeatedly. So that's one of the reasons this model is so valuable, in my view, is you do get a lot of input constantly, and not just from traditional consumer angles of, you know, my service isn't working or my warranty needs to be updated or whatever. You get it from people who actually contribute, either by making changes themselves or suggesting changes or participating in ISOC. But in terms of consumers, I think a lot of them do recognize and appreciate pretty widely what is out there today, and they usually demand it from us, and then we have to try to provide it.
Can I make 2 points about that? First, every one of the billion-dollar web companies today, including some of those in the room, were started by web consumers or internet consumers, right? Not by the network providers. They're consumers. Secondly, it's the consumers that create the pull for innovation, right? It's the fact that somebody offers, you know, a cool new service that's kind of flaky back in the original days, and people go, wow, this is so cool, I can call anywhere in the world. And everybody begins downloading the software and using it, and that's what creates the innovation. So the consumers, in my opinion, are the absolute drivers, the engine of the innovation. In every possible way.
I think it's fair to say that it's not always clear when a user is quote-unquote just a user or when they're the next inventor of something huge. And that's an important key facet of the internet. I briefly saw some hands go up. All right, in the middle of the back, please.
Good morning. Ron Andruff, Dot Sport, LLC. In this discussion on pushing technical boundaries, and specifically what you said in this last question, we're talking about the development at endpoints and innovation at the edge. The filtering bubble is certainly detrimental to true net neutrality. Most consumers have no idea that it's happening to them. It's just come to light in this last period. So how can filtering by ISPs, Google, Facebook, and the like be combated? Who's going to take this up? At which level or layer or which organization will actually do the fighting on behalf of consumers?
So I can tell you who's not going to take it up, and that is the federal telecommunications regulators, the FCC, because the way the statute works, the things that you're describing, and it's funny, I learned about this too for the first time this morning, when we talk about net neutrality, the inside the beltway definition of that is avowedly asymmetric, meaning it applies to companies that provide internet access or access networks, right? So the non-discrimination guarantee that could potentially police the kind of behavior you're talking about is all happening lower down on the stack, right? And and because the statute limits the agency's authority, it's our view, and I think the commission's view, that as you get higher up, they're without jurisdiction to police that kind of conduct, and so you start moving over to other parts of the government like the Federal Trade Commission. So it's not the FCC, and it may be something more like a consumer protection rationale for intervention around the kind of conduct you're describing.
And I guess my additional comment to your question is I hope that you are an ISOC member, and more, I hope you are an ISOC New York chapter member, because then you too can be part of the representing the fight for the good side. Over there, please.
Thank you. My name is Pari Aftab, and it depends on the moment of the day as to who I am. But I was the one that Vint pulled out of practicing a very lucrative practice and conned into doing policy and safety and societal work, I don't know how many years ago. So when we talk about the consumers, we need to recognize that the internet is no longer one way. And that's how it used to be. So when we first looked at the societal steering group and the Internet Society Societal Committee, we really need to now look at the need for bringing the societal non-geeks into the room. I'm a lawyer. If I were smart enough, I would have been an engineer. But I'm not. But I'm on Dr. Phil and Good Morning America and the Today Show, and I'm the one who knows what the consumers want, and then I call Vint or other people in the room and say, what are they talking about? So I think it's time that, as all of us who are in technology, start engaging the consumers. I've got two of the teens from my Teen Angel program here today. Verizon uses them on absolutely everything, and Google does, and everybody else does when they look for experts. And my Wired moms named Skype one of the top five technologies that they love the most in this country. Well, I called Microsoft. I didn't know who to call on the PR. So, and our summit was last Wednesday with IP6. How can I compete with Vint? But what we need to do is all start recognizing that network, no network, who's in the room, who's not in the room, regulators or no regulators. In the end, this is all run by the consumers. Because if somebody decides they want this, they're going to get this. And so they're driving things differently. Unless you engage them, unless you listen to them, and unless the Internet Society brings in young people and regular consumers like 78-year-olds who really get this, we're lost. So my challenge, I guess, less of a question, is really building on the other question about consumers is, we can define it all we want, but we need to make sure everybody's at the table, and that means you need consumers there. And I'm happy to help again, whatever you need me to do. But it's time we start doing that. We need to make the Internet Society relevant across all aspects of technology, meaning how people's lives are being impacted.
Great. Thank you. Does the panel have any comments or thoughts they'd like to add to that?
Just wholehearted agreement that consumers have to be there. The endpoints, you can refer to them any way you want, but it's the consumers that really drive the innovation. The one challenge is if, by some means, providers were able to dampen the enthusiasm for new services or what have you in the consumer base, then we might have a problem. If it weren't possible to see that your friend had a cool app that you don't have and now you want to get it, and you need to get it off the web or the internet, if that were somehow blocked, you know, maybe there might be a problem. But as long as that access to new innovations at other endpoints is there, the consumers will keep driving this thing.
But as you looked at the competition part of the things we need to do, as you looked at the competition part of what things need to do, if one network decides you can't have it, you'll go someplace else.
Let's put that on the table, because I think that's the 800 pound gorilla or elephant or what have you in the room. And that is, you know, it would be, I think, relatively simple if the lower layer providers of the world, the Verizons and so on, just wanted to compete at that level.
Right.
But unfortunately, you know, in this open capitalist society we have, everybody wants to compete at every level. So I think the fear is that the providers of the pipes will give preference to the apps that they put on the pipes against the other apps that are on the pipes. I mean, that's what, in essence, this is, if not all about, a lot about. Yeah. And maybe we should somehow address that.
If I can just leap in there, that was sort of the essence of the point of the definitions that we spun through at the beginning of this session, right? If you are offering those other apps over the same pipes, that's fine, but be clear about what you're offering as the internet, and make sure you keep offering it as advertised in order to enable to have continued competition.
Can I give two analogies just to get us going? One is the electrical network, right? Originally, the providers of the electricity were the appliance manufacturers as well. They sold appliances, the apps for the electrical grid, as well as the grid. Fortunately, we outgrew that by and large. And the other one is the road network that we all use, right? Imagine if the people who built the roads also competed as automobile manufacturers.
Right. Or railway tracks.
Right. So keep those in mind.
I'm still unclear. When you say give preference, what do you mean? The Apple store is the Apple store. We have no control over what they offer in terms of apps in that store. And the same thing, you know, with Google Store. We don't manage those stores. So how are we going to give preference to
an app? Blocking Skype.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. I'd like to add something onto that.
If this is going to happen on a wide scale, for example, text messaging is a big part of our business.
They're going to start slinging.
Do you know you can get text messaging apps that are free today on our smartphones? Nobody's blocked those. People are using them today. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. So Hunter,
I think Nick has been being patient
and trying to get in.
I think you hit the nail on the head. Your comment is assuming there is an internet that's open, then the consumers drive everything. That's off the table because of what Nick just said for two reasons. The two reasons are, if there aren't multiple networks to compete, you can't just go from this one to that one. Oh, they don't let me have it, so I'm going to go to this one. What if there is only one? And Nick's comment about the higher layer operators deciding to get into even higher layers and start to compete, and great point about the road. Who built the Grand Central Parkway? Vanderbilt. Why? So he could drive his car to the city. Okay. Imagine if that was the only car that was allowed on the Grand Central Parkway. There wouldn't be any traffic problems, but you wouldn't really be able to use the GCP. So the other big issue with net neutrality is that it gets all hazy and murky. It's not about the internet, but it's really about network neutrality at the FCC, which, as what Chris said, is about access to the internet. So let's say you're a consumer and you want to consume WikiLeaks. So the net neutrality says that the government will protect the rights of the citizens to access all legal content. What's the definition of legal? Who defines what legal is? And what if the government said WikiLeaks is illegal and they had a piece of paper in their hand that they could tell every ISP in the United States to block that domain? Now you're a consumer and you want to consume that content, but you can't because legally it's not allowed. So we've got multiple issues going on here. Multiple legal issues, consumer issues, and you said it, and so did Nick. It comes down to the physical paths. If this guy won't sell it to me, I'll go to this network. Well, there's got to be another network for that to happen. And that occurs, unfortunately, for everybody that wants to talk about higher layer applications, which I love, that occurs down in the lower boring layers where everything's kind of like nothing happens, like the bottom of the ocean where things don't change much. Nick is spot on with that. That is absolutely accurate statement. You have to watch out for when the guy that sells the dark fiber decides he wants to light the network and no longer wants to sell dark fiber. The guy that just lit the network now sells IP. He doesn't want to sell clear channel transport anymore. The guy that sells IP now wants to start offering voice over IP services and doesn't want to allow competing VoIP services over his network, and so on and so on.
Okay, I think I'd like to take us in a slightly different direction. We have a comment, a question from the back channel again from Eaton Wexler. Eitan, thank you. Adding network capacity won't decrease spam, which is choking the internet. How do we significantly decrease spam with a pointer to sources, short-term or longer-term? And I would suggest the panel consider it more broadly than just spam, but all forms of unwanted traffic and the extent to which that is a defensive challenge consuming resources and getting in the way of investing in innovation.
Part of it is going back to the collaborative nature of the internet, that companies have to work together on this, and they have incentives to do that. Because a lot of the spam is using up capacity that we want our consumers to be able to use and not being wasted on spam. So, for example, we not too long ago actually did combine with some other companies to sue a major spammer, and we actually did win. The FTC has actually enforced this as well. And there are organizations that actually do focus a lot with ISPs working together on trying to combat spam. It's a never-ending battle. I'm not saying that we have solved it, and it, you know, frankly, when you're talking about sending out millions of emails and hoping you get one head out of a million, I mean, it's not economically it's too hard for you to see why people do this. But I do think there's progress being made, and there's also increasing improvements in the way the spam filters work. We certainly have had complaints from time to time about increases in spam, but over time I'm seeing less and less of that. So I think we're getting better at it. But yes, continuing work is needed, and I think it's mainly a collaborative process. The companies having to work together because the incentives are there to not make this capacity get used for things that are just not useful.
Other comments?
We live in an open, free society, and I get junk mail. I'd like to cut down on the junk mail, but I can't stop the post office. So,
they're stopping themselves out here. They're going to shut down Saturday delivery.
So we'll shut down the internet on Saturday and no one will get spammed. Does that make everybody happy? Spam-free Saturdays. Vint Cerf, another innovation.
All right. Chris, you look like you wanted to leap in. No? No takers? All right, then. So I'd like to come back to the wireless question. And just briefly, sort of following up how Vint was framing it, as it stands today, my understanding is it's possible to get data plans for any number of devices, some of them built, sold, and delivered by companies that have no wireless access networks interest themselves, Apple. But it is not possible to do point-to-point connections over IP between handsets, for instance, because of the way wireless networks are architected. Now, my point is the wireless... Wireless is clearly key to the future. And this is, my points actually were from a discussion with wireless providers on a different continent, so I'm not looking at you, Link. But the point stands, and to use Vint's better framing of it, at what point do we expect to actually see devices connected to a wireless internet be internet nodes and speak IP? As full-on internet service nodes? Or is it not a problem?
That's you, Link.
Yeah, but I don't really understand the gist of the question, I'll be honest with you.
So
what are you driving at?
What I'm driving at is I can put my handset on a data plan today, and I can access a number of things over the internet based on the applications that Apple has elected to provide me to put on the internet. But, for instance... I cannot then get my handset to connect directly to another device sitting next to me on the same wireless network except via a proxy in the core of the Verizon service. And I'm not trying to pick on the Verizon service. I think this is just the way that wireless networks work today, in part because of concerns about what happens if you actually provided direct internet access, open internet access to a device on accessing it over wireless.
Well, if you're talking about like what happens when mesh technology for internet, you know, becomes mainstream, that has a lot of really cool implications. There was a great New York Times article over the weekend about internet in a suitcase, which is exactly that. To get internet access back into Egypt or any other country that shut it down, the Department of Defense or one of the intelligence agencies, I forget which, has now a project underway spending several millions of dollars, which is nothing. Department of State? Yes, thank you. To create these capabilities. Besides, I guess, the Department of State doing this, certainly the DOD is extremely interested for warfighting itself to create mesh networks from the battlefield on up. So it's more a matter of when, not if. And it changes the end-to-end argument. So who knows what will happen because of it. But Chris, you had something you wanted to say about it.
Well, only to say that I don't know the topology that we're discussing here, but this notion of connecting sideways, right, smartphone to smartphone, without the need for a centralized infrastructure that can be shut down by an authoritarian regime. Dan Meredith and Sasha Meinrath are the few folks that you're talking about who are building these basically mesh networking kits in a suitcase. And it's sort of a version of what Skype did at the application layer, but at the access layer.
Yeah.
And it's enormously powerful stuff, particularly as radios become more smart, cognitive, and the software, the middleware, is sort of creates these ad hoc networks where they're most needed without, again, the reliance on a centralized infrastructure. So it's really exciting stuff, and they've done great work.
So might Skype want to do it at the access layer too?
So it's a long story there, but we used to partner with a company called Phone. I don't know, Vint, if you've worked with the guys who did Phone, but that was router-based sharing, kind of the Skype model, but at the router, so you'd share Wi-Fi hotspots. That's as close as we got.
Hello. Okay. All right. I'm going to try to clarify Leslie's question earlier and just repeat it a different way and hopefully get the discussion going again. Which is, I think that she's asking, when would a company like Verizon or other wireless providers give a static IP address to a wireless handset so that if I wanted to, I could install, you know, say the Apache web server and have a website live on the internet and be a full internet citizen, or have my handheld device be a full internet citizen? That's the question.
Thanks. It's a clearer reframing.
Yeah. No, I understand the question. I mean, a lot of this is driven by changes in the technology and the market. So, I don't know where this is going to head either. A lot of this is future. I don't know. We've made a lot of progress to date, and I think some of what these kinds of questions ask are things that consumers ask. I think there will be reactions in the market, but I can't tell you what kinds of things will happen. I mean, that's what you're asking is, will that happen? I don't know. Of course it is, but a lot of things are technically possible. That doesn't mean that it's always going to happen right away. I just don't know the answer to that question.
I think at a higher layer, sort of, let's talk about it from a registry standpoint. When we move away from the LURG and ENUM, which is the architecture, sort of ENUM from the IP sense, but from the LURG, which is the root of the PSTN, which is really the architecture from a dialing perspective, and stop thinking of these things as phones, and move to a real DNS IP architecture sort of hierarchy from the stack higher down, and then think of it from the resolution base to SRV, right, port 5060, to this as a domain-based identifier, then necessarily you'll have an IP address, and that'll enable IP applications, and we'll be there. And I think, okay, it's my personal opinion, LTE has a lot to do with that, because most of the apps that are running today on the wired public internet, they're really not that great on wireless networks because of the fact that it's dynamic, that it's routing dynamically, and that the throughput's not always there. I mean, I look at my phone and I'm in amazement how it goes from edge to GPRS to GSM to UMA to 3G, toggling while I'm standing still in my house. And I couldn't run the same app consistently and get quality of service. It has to do with a lot of issues, backhaul issues and things. But LTE deployment on a broad scale in any country provides the pathway for full-on IP networking, which then will, like Link said, the consumers are already using it, so then it should sort of just meld. And it's a time situation, because you have to upgrade basically everything. And I believe it will happen, for sure. We're on that path. When? Not exactly sure.
When you look at how fast we've progressed, though, from 2G to 3G to now 4G, I mean, we're at 100 million. In Verizon's case, we deployed to already with 4G. We're going to be, by end of 2013 or thereabouts, pretty much all the territory we cover today, which is 290 million people could get access to LTE. So just in four short years, we've essentially deployed to an entire country. And we've deployed speeds that are much, much faster than any DSL available or even cable modem in some cases, and the latency is great. So these networks are going to offer new things, and we're going to see how this is going to play out, what consumers want. I think that's part of what we're doing with these networks, is trying to see what it is they want and trying new business models to see if we can reach their needs better. So part of this, they're good questions, they're good technology issues, but do the consumers want them? Do they demand them? Do they want them to provide it? These are all things we have to see in the marketplace, I think.
Great. So I'd like to thank the panelists for dealing with that question quite so well. We're not quite done yet. We're going to let them have. I would like to give the panelists the opportunity for 30 seconds each, final words. We can go in inverse order. Nick, do you want to start?
Sure. I wish innovation could happen at every layer of the stack simultaneously with equal speed. We can't. So if I'm going to err on the side of innovation, I would prefer to have it happen at the endpoint.
Thanks. Chris?
And I just want to pick up on the consumer point that was mentioned earlier and make two points. One is that as citizens, we need to push our politicians to define what success looks like in this environment. What kind of competition and policy and innovation environment do we want to have? And secondly, keep up the engagement, because what we saw last summer was good. It was a lot of transparency. It was a fair amount of public discourse around the net neutrality rules. There are more important battles that are being fought, in particular around universal service. And if ISOC can be part of that discussion, I think we'll come up with better rules.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think Chris, his point about engagement is really important. I think multi-stakeholderism, we really do believe that whole model for how the internet activities ought to be worked on is really important, and it does drive a lot of change. So the kinds of questions that you're asking today are good ones, and they're the kinds of things that help drive people to start saying, well, maybe we should take a look at that. Maybe there's something new that we can offer. That's how these work. This process works, so it's a very positive in my view. The other quick thing is we didn't really spend a lot of time, although we did talk about consumers, we did not spend anywhere near enough time talking about the fundamental issues they care about. We talked a lot about networks and technologies and things we'd like to see, but those aren't always things that really affect the consumer. Privacy does affect them. Cybersecurity affects them. Online safety affects them. These are all things we're spending a lot of time on, and I'm not just us, but a lot of the industry players are. They're really important. We need to get them right because those also affect a lot of these technologies that you want to see deployed, because if we can't get it right, then it's going to be harder for them to want to use them. So we need to focus a lot more attention on them. That's why I mentioned privacy in my initial remarks. I do think those kinds of issues are ones we have to tackle well. And those, again, multi-stakeholder approaches are much better than having government try to demand how those ought to be done.
I just add to what Link said that one thing that wasn't really discussed, which is a whole other discussion and topic and day probably, is cost. How does it all get paid for in every layer? But going back to one of the original things that I believe Nick mentioned was framing the discussion. So my final comment would be in framing. I, too, am a big believer in defining terms. I can't stand that people use words interchangeably in a conversation, walk away and think they understand what the other said, but really they don't because they have a different definition of the underlying word. And it's very challenging and very problematic, and I spend a great deal of my time personally, professionally, writing about, speaking about, trying to educate in mass everyone and starting at a basis. So I would encourage everyone to really get to the root of the words that each of you have in your minds that you make up, and that is the consistency of your knowledge of what it is that is going on. And when you start to have conversations, as tedious as it may be, make sure you're on the same page with the other person. That way it can be constructive and productive. Thank you.
Great. Great wise words to end on. I'd like to thank you all for coming and participating, and certainly I'd like to thank the panelists for their contributions.